From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. Now less than a week before Election Day, and already more than 73 million Americans have voted by mail or in person. And nearly 8 million of those voters live in Texas.
That number is astounding for the state because it surpasses the total early voting turnout from any other presidential election there. And this record turnout could be the latest sign of a changing Texas. Joining us to break this down is Alana Rocha, a multimedia reporter with the Texas Tribune. Hi, Alana.
Thanks for having me.
Yes, so early voting records have been broken in two counties that are very different in terms of size and voting history and demographics. What does that tell you about the enthusiasm for voting this election in Texas?
There's a unique determination, it seems, maybe not just in Texas, but obviously that's what we cover and we're definitely seeing here for people to cast their ballots this election. Of course, the pandemic, we believe, is driving a lot of the early voting turnout. People want to avoid crowds, want to avoid exposure to the virus. And so you're seeing that across the state. And as you mentioned, two very diverse counties here in the state politically, Denton County up near Dallas in North Texas, and then, of course, Harris County that's home to Houston. Of course, the big cities here have tended to lean Democratic in recent years. Denton County is the conservative stronghold. So you're seeing, no matter the politics, people definitely want their voices heard and heard early this cycle.
To your earlier point, we've heard anecdotally from other places around the country that what's driving people to the polls in record numbers is a feeling that a lot more is at stake this election. What are the reasons you're hearing in Texas?
It's a mixed bag. Of course, it's partisan, depending on, you know, the candidates and what issues they're highlighting on the campaign trail. For Republicans, they are talking about, you know, back the blue and saying that, you know, Democrats want to defund police departments. So that's kind of a rallying cry on the right. On the left, you're seeing health care, a big talking point for those, you know, all the way from the state house to, you know, congressional races.
How much do you think in-state migration is influencing perhaps the changes that you're seeing in terms of voting, early voting numbers?
That is a factor for sure. And we've seen that just because the state added 1.8 million voters since the last presidential election in 2016. But the numbers show that you can't just attribute it to population growth. There is a real enthusiasm and, you know, drive for people to get to the polls. And yes, migration has some to do with that. And we saw that really highlighted in 2018 when you saw normally, you know, Republican stronghold counties in the suburbs flip and vote for Democrat Beto O'Rourke over the incumbent U.S. Senator Ted Cruz.
Mm-hmm. We'll be diving into the Texas Senate race elsewhere in the program, but it's worth noting a lot of heavy spending from both sides up and down the races, the ballot races. There's a lot of outside money coming into Texas, too. What are you seeing?
Yeah, just this week, we published a story and others about Michael Bloomberg investing heavily here in Texas in this final week before the election, some $15 million in TV ad spending. And that's not just for the Senate race, not just for the presidential race. I mean, he's also looking again at the state house where Democrats, especially given now the solid conservative majority on the U.S. Supreme Court, state Democrats see having a say in, or control rather, of one of the chambers here in the state as their way to mitigate what they see as bad legislation before it gets to the court system and could be elevated to the highest court where they are at a disadvantage now.
Well, what do the polls show about the state of the presidential race in Texas? How close is it?
Yeah, well, as far as the race for president, I mean, it's within single digits. Our recent poll, the Texas Tribune with the University of Texas, showed Trump beating Joe Biden by 5 points or within 5 points. And it's, yeah, a matter of looking at trends. And the majority of the polls do show Donald Trump still ahead here in the state, but within single digits. He won by 9 points in 2016, which was the smallest margin of victory for a Republican here in quite some time. And the state, mind you, hasn't elected a Democrat president since Jimmy Carter in 76. So we'll have to see.
And there's also the race for the Electoral College votes.
Yeah, we're the second largest prize in the country when it comes to Electoral College votes. In 2016, you saw two electors defect, and there was a push from the governor to be able to have Texas become the 30th state in the country to bind the electors to the popular vote in the state. It fell short. We're still not one of the 29 states that bind the electors to the popular vote. But the thought here is that if Biden were to take Texas, it's not going to be the deciding state, if you will, as far as putting him over the top to get into the presidency. If he wins Texas, it's more of a sign that it's just a landslide for Biden nationwide.
Alana Rocha is a multimedia reporter with the Texas Tribune. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And let's get a view of the race in Washington state. It's a deep blue state, but one of the big surprises of 2016 was that four reliably Democratic counties flipped for Donald Trump. So what are voters thinking now? David Hyde from member station KUOW is in the mill town of McLary in Grays Harbor County.
If you want to understand the shift in McLary's politics, it helps to start with the McLary Bear Festival and the hundreds of pounds of bear meat that usually go into the stew at the event.
Let's see, we start about 7 o'clock in the morning on Friday, and by 8, 9 o'clock Saturday morning, it's basically ready. And then
the festival's been around since 1959, but last year, something changed. Environmentalists brought a lawsuit that put a stop to some kinds of bear hunting on timberlands. That meant no bear meat in the stew. Jenna Amsbury serves on the McLary City Council, and she's not happy about the ban.
People like tradition. You know, sometimes it'd be nice to have different ways that you could work around, you know, regulations.
The bear hunting controversy is symbolic of long simmering political tensions over the environment and other issues that boiled over here in 2016. That's when Donald Trump became the first Republican presidential candidate to win Grays Harbor County since Herbert Hoover back in 1928. Ben Anderstone is a political consultant based in Seattle.
McLary is kind of the epicenter of this swing in Washington state. It had one of the strongest swings towards Donald Trump. It's an ancestrally Democratic town. It voted for Trump, and in 2018, it even voted Republican for U.S. Senate.
So why did this place go so red so fast? Linda Thompson's president of the McLary Historical Society.
I don't know why the change. I don't know who switched, because the people that I know are longtime Republicans.
Thompson's a Democrat. She says she can't think of a single person in town who flipped from Obama to Trump, except...
I know one. He's not in this county, but he's my son.
Thompson says her son voted for Obama and still loves Obama, but now he's a Trump voter. He lives just down the road in Mason County, which, like Grays Harbor County, also turned red for Trump in 2016. Republican Suzanne Hickel lives there, too. She supported Obama and used to be an independent, but last election, she voted Trump.
I never voted party, and I really only started voting party in the last election.
Hickel calls Trump a strong man. She likes that he told Washington Governor Jay Inslee to crack down hard on protests. She thinks black people are right to protest unfair policing, but she doesn't support some of their tactics.
I think Trump will wield a little bit more power and force to hopefully get the country back on track.
But it's not just about Trump. Historian Steve Beda at the University of Oregon says voters in Northwest Timber Country have been losing faith in the Democratic Party over a long period of time. For most of the 20th century, he says, they were radically pro-union and pro-Democratic Party. But things changed. For one thing, unions declined. And Beda says another big turning point came in the early 1990s when Democrats started to embrace a new kind of environmental politics to protect forests that never delivered on the promises to also protect jobs.
All of the money that was supposed to be earmarked for job retraining, of helping timber workers transition away from a resource extraction economy, a lot of that funding never came to fruition or was never paid out.
Timber towns felt like they were being abandoned by Democrats. And in 2016, they swung to Donald Trump, who promised to bring timber jobs back to the Northwest. But so far, neither place has recovered jobs lost in the Great Recession of 2008. And today, there are fewer lumber and wood products jobs in Mason County than in 2016, and only a slight uptick in Grays Harbor County. Political consultant Ben Anderstone says Biden could win out here. But longer term, he says the drift away from the Democratic Party may be hard to stop. For Here and Now, I'm David Hyde.
After a long and difficult year, the City of Angels is celebrating.
Dave Roberts. And strike three! Dodgers have won it all in 2020!
The Los Angeles Dodgers won their first World Series title since 1988, beating the Tampa Bay Rays 3-1 last night.
Dodger third baseman Justin Turner had to be removed mid-game after testing positive for COVID-19. Turner is the first player to test positive this postseason, but he says he feels fine and he was seen celebrating on the field after the game. And you know, Tanya, my first memory of baseball was that 1988 series with Kirk Gibson famously pumping his fists around the bases. So it has been a while for Dodgers fans.
Yes, and from my house last night in SoCal, all you could see was fireworks in the sky as Angelinos celebrated this long-awaited victory.
Thomas Keller is one of the country's most honored chefs. His restaurants have been awarded 7 Michelin stars, 3 for the French Laundry in Yountville, California, 3 for Per Se in New York City, and 1 for Bouchon. His latest cookbook is out this week. The French Laundry Per Se is named for Thomas Keller's 2 marquee restaurants. It includes recipes, beautiful photographs, lessons learned from his decades of cooking. Thomas Keller joins me now on Skype. Thank you for being here. Your book begins with an acknowledgement that the pandemic has really upended your industry. How hard has COVID hit you and your restaurants?
Well, like everybody else, I think the hospitality profession was one of the hardest hit. We are the largest private employer in America, and we employ close to 16 million people solely just in the restaurant profession. That's not including lodging, hotels, and things like that, nor is that including the supply chain. So you can imagine, you know, if you start to add all those others in, we're well over 20 million people. And so the pandemic shut us down overnight. The 18th of March here in Yountville was our last service for 4 restaurants and close to 450 employees, which the next day, you know, 95% of them were furloughed. So it was a devastating blow and one that I think, as most restaurateurs and most chefs, we pivot. We're able to develop different ways of nurturing our guests. And so here in Yountville, we did that by keeping our general managers and our chef de cuisines, who then worked feeding our community, making roughly over 500 meals a day for our community and for our staff that had been furloughed.
Right. You know, and pivoting is not the same as opening your restaurant at full capacity. Have you had the ability to look at your books and to see, you know, how much 2020 will end up costing you when it's all said and done?
We don't know. I mean, it's all speculation right now. I mean, we lost in all of our restaurants from 7 to 8 months worth of business. And certainly at one of the most important times, the spring, summer, and even part of the fall. But, you know, we're optimistic. You know, our team takes care of our guests. And then we also want to make sure that we're taking care of our partners who are suppliers, you know, our farmers, our fishermen, our foragers, our gardeners. And, you know, our purpose is to make sure that we face those challenges with strength and conviction and commitment.
Yeah. And well, as time passes, it looks like you are starting to make some progress, too. I see in the San Francisco Chronicle that the French Laundry reopened to indoor dining in September, 3 tables available at a time, $850 per person. Talk me through that decision-making. I mean, is it safe to have people back in your restaurant?
Well, I mean, we're following all of the regulations and the rules, you know, that have been set out by not just state government, but CDC as well. Social distancing with 3 tables in the restaurant is fairly easy because we have basically 4 rooms. And so we're occupying 3 of those 4 rooms for approximately 15 people in total who are allowed to have inside our restaurant. And really what we want to do is make sure that the guest is comfortable and feel safe and that our staff is comfortable and feel safe.
Mm. The other question is about the price tag. I mean, who can pay $850 per person for a meal? You know, we're in the middle of a historic recession. So many people are hurting. And I know some people responded to your reopening announcement by saying that it was tone deaf. Do you think that's fair?
Well, you know, we have to think about where the $850 came from. So what we've been doing for over a decade was an experience card. And that experience card affords them a special experience. So the silver card is the least expensive. Then there was the gold card and then the black card. The black card offers them this extraordinary dining experience inside our historic dining room. it's not for everybody. We admit that. But it's for those who, you know, who've been pent up for 7 or 8 months, not being able to get dressed up to go out to dinner, not being able to celebrate their birthday, not being able to celebrate their anniversary, not being able to celebrate their wedding or their engagement or any of those celebratory moments that people have throughout the year. And they felt that this was a great opportunity for them to experience something at an elevated level that was an experience that they could remember. So I don't think we were tone deaf. I think we really understand, you know, where we are today.
And this is the context in which you come out with this beautiful new cookbook, The French Laundry Per Se. Let's talk about that for just a minute. I know that you wrote in here that one of your goals was to reflect the evolution of fine dining over the past 26 years. How has it evolved in that time?
So when we opened the French Laundry, my goal was to open, you know, a wonderful restaurant that gave our guests an extraordinary experience through the quality of the food that we sourced from our suppliers, through the quality of the service that we offered to our guests, the quality of the wine list, and of course, the quality of the environment. And so that became, for me, you know, a fine dining environment. The tasting menu was the cornerstone of what we did. And we evolved into just a pure tasting menu 5 or 6 years after we initially opened our restaurant. It's an evolution that allows people to feel more comfortable, I think, in a restaurant that's fine dining. You know, when I was younger, fine dining restaurants were relatively intimidating. They weren't run by chefs. They were more or less run by maitre d's or restaurateurs. And there was a feeling that you were, you know, if you weren't of the right background or the right knowledge or correctly dressed, you were going to be somehow discriminated against. It was just a difficult situation. And that's not something that I believed in. I believe that whatever kind of dining you want to experience, fine dining or casual dining, it should be a place where you have a great amount of comfort.
And that's exactly why I asked you about the cost of the meal when people return to the restaurant. I mean, because, you know, if something costs $850 a plate, for instance, or even a couple hundred dollars a plate, I mean, how do you make that accessible to everybody so that they don't feel like they're unwelcomed because they're a certain kind of person?
Well, I don't think you can. The amount of the experience is going to be different for everybody. You know, our normal tasting menu, which compromises about 90% of our guests, is $355. You know, and that's still expensive. I still recognize that as being expensive. But if you compare that to other 3-star dining establishments around the world, we're one of the least expensive. And it's accessible to everybody. We have had a number of people who come in, young people who come in, who are saving their money so they can have this type of experience. And it's very important for them. So we're trying to produce the best possible experience with the best possible ingredients, the best possible staff. And that's how much it costs to do that. And so accessibility is in question, but accessibility in anything is in question, whether you're buying a suit, whether you're going to a Broadway play, what doctor that you have. I mean, if you're talking about accessibility, you know, fine dining is probably the least of concerns about what accessibility is, because there's so many other more things that are needed in person's life than fine dining. So this is a bit of a luxury.
There was a point in the book that I thought was very interesting. You point out that the 70 plus recipes are in fact pretty elaborate and even more complex than the ones that were in the first French Laundry cookbook. Do you think, like, if someone, a novice, were to get this book, he or she would be able to pull off the recipes inside it?
You'd have to define what a novice is. Well, our approach to our cookbooks from the very beginning have always been recipes and techniques that we use in our restaurants. In other words, they haven't been written for the home cook, because we don't really know who the home cook is. I mean, there's some home cooks out there who are pretty skillful, who have, you know, pretty robust equipment in their great kitchens. I think that the book is so well written in the procedural process that if somebody who has the ambition and a certain amount of skill, they could achieve a result that would be, you know, I don't want to say exactly what we do, because it's not, but it's going to be something that I think they could be proud of. And I think that's really the important thing about cooking, is you're cooking for somebody. It's an affectionate thing. I mean, it's something that is emotional. And no matter how well it comes out, the most important thing about cooking for somebody is sharing that affection, sharing that love, sharing that emotion.
So walk me through one of your favorites from the book. Which one do you like the most?
Well, you know, it's like asking me which shot I like the most. That's unfair. But, you know, I'll point out one that was kind of reflected in the French Laundry cookbook. It was called Yabba Dabba Doo in the French Laundry cookbook. And it was a cote de bœuf, right, or a slice of prime rib on the bone. But we did steak and potatoes in the French Henri Percet cookbook, which is a tribute not only to what we were used to as kids, having steak and potatoes, right? We always talk about people who just love steak and potatoes, but also, you know, a tribute to Yabba Dabba Doo. And, you know, this is a beautiful, again, you know, a beautiful bone-in rib steak with some of my favorites from a kid, tater tots, and then a salad with green goddess dressing. So you look at these different things, and those pan-roasted, you know, steak on bone, tater tots, and green goddess dressing on romaine lettuce. Does that sound like it is approachable? Does that sound like it's accessible?
Yes. Sounds quite edible as well.
Right. So there you go. I mean, that's a recipe that, you know, I believe most people who want to eat steak and potatoes and have a green goddess salad, those elements are really easy. They could actually start to extract some of the sub-recipes. Steak and potatoes has the tater tots as a sub-recipe, or the green goddess dressing as a sub-recipe. Those two things you can make any time. You can make a green goddess dressing, and you can make a, you know, a pint of it or a quart of it, you know, have it on hand for 2 weeks and use it on different things. It could become a sauce for a piece of fish. It can be a sauce for a piece of chicken. Of course, you can dress salads with it. I mean, you could have lentil salad with green goddess dressing. There's so many different things you can do with it. So I think that, you know, if you're really going to use a cookbook, it's not about taking the recipes or the compositions that we've done that come directly from our restaurants. Remember that, come from directly from our restaurants. There's no, they're not dumbed down at all. But the sub-recipes in there are so valuable. And then the techniques and the skills that we're trying to teach are so valuable. So look beyond just the superficial part of it and say, okay, do I really want to cook the all artichoke? That's a process, but is there something in there that I can learn from that recipe?
Chef Thomas Keller, the new book is The French Laundry Per Se. Thank you so much for speaking with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks for your time. Be well. Stay safe.
And we'll have his recipe for steak and potatoes at hereandnow.org.
The coronavirus, of course, has kept many travelers from riding subways and buses, and those systems are starting to feel the financial weight of the drop in ridership. For more on the larger implications, let's bring in Here and Now transportation analyst Seth Kaplan. Hey, Seth.
Hey, Tanya.
So the American Public Transportation Association, which represents over 1,500 transit systems nationwide, says most will be forced to cut staff and service unless they get additional relief from the federal government. Could the financial situation get even worse without this relief?
It could, because these are what you call fixed cost systems, Tanya. And what that means is that these are systems that cost roughly the same amount to run, no matter how many people are using them. Running a rush hour train, even if it's empty, costs nearly as much as it does when it's packed, but you don't have all that fare revenue from riders. And so people can just disagree on the details of how bad it is and what they should get, but they're clearly right that this is a financial catastrophe for them.
What do the numbers tell us? Generally speaking, what are transit ridership numbers looking like right now?
Way off. This is one of the areas in the world, you know, nothing's normal right now, but there are some industries that are somewhat resilient, and then there are others that are just still very much in the middle of the crisis, and that's the case here. All of these systems, not only off their highs, but in most cases down by at least half in terms of ridership.
Yeah, you know, as we get deeper into this pandemic, studies have shown that public transportation does not spread the virus as much as originally thought. But many people, of course, don't feel safe hopping on a subway or train or a bus. What measures have these systems taken to help reduce the spread?
Pretty much the same ones that society has taken. Masking, social distancing, which on a train or a bus sometimes means not allowing people to get on that train or bus. I've seen buses go by in a city, as you know, this bus is full, but it's not packed with people standing shoulder to shoulder. Yeah. Might have just a couple dozen people on it.
Yep. Why should someone care about public transportation? I mean, how does keeping these systems humming impact the overall economy?
Well, public transportation advocates say the reason it matters even to people who don't use it is that it takes cars off the road. So in other words, if you see a bus full of people, even if you're not on that bus, even if you're driving a car, well, imagine all those people, maybe not as many now as usual, but you know, in normal times, a few dozen people all in separate single occupancy vehicles that would make traffic worse for you. That's what advocates say.
Another rail system suffering in this pandemic is Amtrak. The company is projecting a 70% decline in ridership next year, down from pre-pandemic levels. What measures has Amtrak taken to deal with its financial woes?
Well, one is that it's asking for money, just like public transportation systems are doing, just like airlines are doing. And like all of them, it got a first tranche of aid, not a subsequent one. And then, of course, it's taking all the same measures, the masking and social distancing. The social distancing, of course, is very costly for these systems because, you know, when you can't sell as many seats, whether you're an airline that's blocking the middle seat or whether you're Amtrak, and then it's that costs money. And then obviously demand is just down. Amtrak has also cut some of its long distance trains down to as much as just three times per week through a lot of cities in America.
Wow. Here and Now transportation analyst Seth Kaplan, as always, thank you.
Thank you, Tanya.
You're listening to Here and Now. The Gulf Coast is yet again getting battered by another hurricane. Zeta is the 27th named Atlantic storm following hurricanes Laura and Sally. Jeff Huffman is tracking this storm, and he's the director and chief meteorologist of the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. And Jeff, when and where do you expect this landfall?
Well, good afternoon, Tanya. Landfall is imminent within the next few hours across portions of southeast Louisiana, coming very close to the city of New Orleans, and then it will likely also make a second landfall early this evening along the Mississippi and Alabama Gulf coasts. The storm currently has winds of around 90 miles per hour. It's a strong Category 1, could be close to Category 2 by the time it makes landfall here in the next few hours.
For folks who are not from this area, because they know based on what you're telling us what they can expect, what is the biggest concern for Zeta? Is it the damage from the winds or the heavy rain or the flooding?
Well, every storm is unique, and this one is as well. Thankfully, this one is moving quickly, so the heavy rainfall will be mitigated by its fast forward motion. Still some localized flooding possible, but because it is moving so fast and somewhat intensifying still, storm surge is a significant concern along those very vulnerable coastlines of Mississippi, Alabama, and Lake Pontchartrain in southeast Louisiana. Storm surge values there expected to be anywhere between 4 and 9 feet. Storm surge could also affect portions of the Florida Panhandle. And then also because of its fast forward motion, tornadoes are a risk. In addition, of course, to the potential hurricane force winds, there could be several tornadoes with this storm on its eastern side, possibly spreading as far inland and as far east as portions of the Florida Panhandle and well up into portions of Alabama and Georgia later tonight.
Oh, my gosh. So put this in perspective for us. An average season sees 6 hurricanes and 12 named storms. How does Zeta compare with the other hurricanes that have hit the Gulf Coast this particular season?
Well, there are so many records to mention this year, but some of the most glaring ones are the fact that this will likely be the 11th named storm to hit this year. We broke the record earlier this year, which was 9, hitting the U.S. in 1916. This will also likely break a record for Louisiana landfalls in a single season at 5. The previous record was 4 in 2002. And it's also now the strongest hurricane in the Gulf this far west this late in the season. So I could list off many more records as well. It has certainly been a hyperactive season and a historic hurricane season in the Atlantic Basin.
Yeah, I mean, Jeff, we're in the Greek alphabet for storm names. Are you anticipating more storms before the season ends?
Well, officially, the season ends November 30th. We do see the weather pattern changing a bit in the next 2 weeks. We have a couple of strong cold fronts that will likely move all the way off the coast of Florida. That should at least, hopefully, fingers crossed, keep another storm from approaching the U.S. But we can't let our guard down. We had Hurricane Kate hit portions of the Florida Panhandle late in November. That has happened before, so we still have to watch. That was back in 1985. So, of course, we will keep a watch for the next few weeks, but fingers crossed, hopefully, this will be the last one, at least in the U.S.
Absolutely. Jeff Huffman is director and chief meteorologist of the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Okay, let's hear more on the voting underway right now and those long lines in states across the country. But what if you're physically unable to stand for long periods of time? For some 38 million voters with disabilities, voting comes with challenges. Studies have shown that 1 in 3 voters with disabilities will face difficulty voting at polling places. Sabrina Epstein is a Johns Hopkins University student with a disability that prevents her from standing in line for long stretches to vote. And facing these barriers in her own life, she's become a vocal advocate for disability rights, and she joins us now. Sabrina, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Yes. So how did you cast your ballot this election?
I was able to cast my own private independent ballot through vote by mail, but I had to jump through some hoops to do so. They don't make it easy. I can't vote in person for a couple of reasons. First, that many polling places are inaccessible, even though they're required by law to be ADA compliant. That's pretty rarely enforced. And also standing in long lines is not something I can do with my disability. And also I'm high risk for COVID-19. So the idea of going to a polling place amongst all these crowds of early voters is not something that would work for me this year.
What has been the breakdown why these polling places, which are often libraries and churches and places like that, not ADA compliant?
It's mostly a matter of enforcement. When federal laws at the most basic level, like the Americans with Disabilities Act, which has been around for 30 years, isn't enforced by the federal government, then it all trickles down to creating even more problems at the state and local level.
I know also in places like Texas, poll workers have to give disabled people priority when standing in line to vote, but that is not a law in Maryland yet. What else can Maryland do to improve accessibility for voters with disabilities?
While it's really exciting to see these images of long lines to vote because so many people are early voting, to people with physical disabilities like myself, that is an image of inaccessibility. So some states do have laws requiring poll workers to prioritize people with disabilities and older adults, and in some states, parents of children with disabilities or caregivers. Another change that I'm concerned about is that last week the Supreme Court reinstated a ban on curbside voting in Alabama, which is another form of accessible voting, to be able to have someone bring out a ballot to your car. And the Supreme Court decided that Alabama can continue its ban on curbside voting, which is just a huge step backwards, especially right now when people are trying not to be in big crowds because of social distancing.
I want to ask you about something else. Can you describe the electronic voting system for blind voters in Maryland?
Yeah, so here in Maryland, there's two different options for blind and low vision voters. The first would be to go to a polling place and use a ballot marker. Every polling place is required to have at least one ballot marking device, which lets you be able to hear what's on the ballot. However, this sometimes becomes a problem because if only blind and low vision voters are using this device, then it becomes a segregated form of voting. So some poll workers are trying to encourage people without disabilities to also use these ballot marking devices. The other option is newer here in Maryland and came about due to a blind advocacy group's lawsuit, the National Federation for the Blind, which allows voters to request a ballot electronically, which they can fill out on their computer at home, mm-hmm. which is really excellent because it allows people to use a screen reader to read them the ballot and fill it out privately and independently, which, as we know, is the goal. However, you then have to print it out and mail it in. And of course, not everyone has printers or access to the internet or a screen reader technology. So although it's a huge step forward, there's still a lot of barriers for blind and low vision voters.
Yeah. And as you speak, I'm just thinking about access to information about all of this. Is it really clear? I guess it really depends on where you live, whether or not you have access to even know these resources are available to you.
Absolutely. It's hard to figure out what all the options are for voting, especially right now with COVID and so many of the rules and policies changing around voting. And on top of that, it's hard to find accessible information from candidates, especially local candidates down the ballot. Not all of their websites are accessible to people using screen readers. They don't all have high contrast text, and not all of their videos are captioned. And it's really frustrating to feel left out of the political discussion, even just in that what some may say is a small way.
Every election season, there's a call to action to be more accessible for folks with disabilities. But this particular election is different than others because we're seeing record turnout at voting places and really a push for people to vote by mail. What changes do you still hope to see come out of this election?
I do hope that vote by mail sticks around as an option for all voters, but it's important for the disability community that vote by mail is not the only option that's available. Because as you can see, although voting by mail is the most accessible option for my particular disability, it's not for everyone. We all have different experiences.
That's Sabrina Epstein, a student in Maryland who advocates for the rights of people with disabilities. Thank you so much, Sabrina.
Thanks for having me.
Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf mobilized the National Guard to respond to violence and looting that broke out during protests in Philadelphia last night following the police killing of 27-year-old Walter Wallace Jr. on Monday. Wallace's family says he was in the grip of a mental health crisis. Here's his cousin Sam White talking to NBC 10 Philadelphia.
Police officers are trained to defuse and de-escalate situations, or they should be trained to defuse and de-escalate situations. There could have been something else done before you take a person's life.
And there are many who agree with that. Joining us now on Skype is Alex Vitale, a professor of sociology and coordinator of the Policing and Social Justice Project at Brooklyn College. Alex, thanks for being here.
You bet, Peter.
And Wallace's family say that his mother called for an ambulance, but it was the police that arrived first. So when you look at what happened in Philadelphia this week and you hear that cut from Wallace's cousin, what's your reaction?
Well, we have this systemic problem that goes so far beyond this one case. We know, for instance, that police in the United States, between a quarter and a half of all the people they kill are having a mental health crisis. And we've completely eviscerated any kind of community-based mental health system, left people vulnerable to having mental health crises. And then when people call for help, what they usually get is an armed police response. And too often, this just leads to these terrible outcomes.
When the police arrived on this scene, what do you think they should have done?
Well, I think they should have tried to keep their distance. We hear this narrative, well, he had a knife, and therefore we had no choice but to shoot him. But really, they could have engaged in what's called a strategic retreat. The mother was there on the scene trying to talk to him. She was not in immediate danger, and they could have waited to take action. They could have waited for the ambulance to come. They could have waited possibly for a clinical mental health response. But instead, they have this force neutralization mindset that unfortunately leads actually to the escalation of violence.
The police chief in Philadelphia has acknowledged a few important details in this case. Number one, that the officers on the scene didn't have tasers. Do you think that was a mistake? I mean, could that have helped save his life?
Perhaps it could have, although we've seen many cases where even officers with tasers have resorted to deadly violence very quickly in these situations.
Another detail the police chief revealed is that a program designed to put a mental health professional in the dispatch room when a 911 call comes in was still in its infancy, and it wasn't in place for this call. As the details here emerge about the police response, what kind of questions do you think that the department should have to answer?
I think the department has to answer why they feel the need to intervene in every single one of these calls. I think we have to ask a bigger question, which is why the political leadership of Philadelphia refuses to fund non-police-based mental health services and crisis response teams that other cities are rapidly implementing all across the country.
Well, Ed, there has been, as you well know, calls to defund the police or to move money into these types of programs that you refer to, non-police responses to things like mental health, drug abuse, and homelessness. I mean, is that the answer to the problem that we're facing across the country right now?
That's only one part of the answer, right? We need to change this crisis response capacity. So in Oregon, they have a pretty robust system there that's integrated into the 911 system. Last year, they went on 24,000 of these calls, and they only requested police backup in 150, less than 1%. It's now 20% of all 911 calls go to this non-police response. But also, we have to create the baseline community mental health services so that we don't have so many crisis calls in the first place. Mr. Wallace was someone who had a long history of mental health challenges. And if those challenges had been addressed more successfully, then this entire episode might never have happened.
And you referred there to a program called CAHOOTS. We've reported on that here. The fact is, though, many departments are not doing those types of training programs, and police are still often the only resource for people to call in these situations. And then when they get on the scene, it's a very complicated and tough situation for these officers to deal with. Do you have any sympathy for the situation that they find themselves in?
Look, a lot of police do not want to be in the mental health business. I actually spoke with Commissioner Outlaw not long ago about this at an event at the University of Texas Law School, and she's very sympathetic to this idea that we need to build up community-based mental health services and we need to create alternative response capacities.
And why aren't more departments doing that?
It's not up to police departments. It's up to city councils and mayors. And I think we have to ask some tough questions of them about why they're not up to this task. They continue to sort of embrace this austerity politics that says that the only way we can solve our problems is to turn it over to police. And that is really what's causing a lot of these problems.
Alex Vitale is a professor of sociology and coordinator of the Policing and Social Justice Project at Brooklyn College. Thanks for your time.
You bet.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now. Alexandra Pelosi spent the past year talking to people around the country for her latest film, and she says the U.S. is even more divided than previously thought. That's next time on Here and Now.